History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 4 in our series, Key Battles of World War I. In the previous episode, we looked at our first battle, the Battle of Tannenberg, and saw that although Germany faced unexpected resistance on the Eastern Front with Russia, they were able to handle the threat. This is maybe the high point in World War I for Germany, and we're only a few months into it. So things aren't going to be going well for them or really anyone else as we go along. We're going to be shifting from Eastern Front to the Western Front in this episode. And something we're going to see here is that each of these great powers have plans. Each of these plans unravel fairly quickly. And something I want to mention before we get too far into this is that part of the reason why the plans unravel is that it's very hard for a military strategist not to plan for the future by using the last war. Something that we mentioned over and over again, or at least I did during the Civil War, so much to the point that it became part of a drinking game where you take a shot every time I mention Napoleon, is that generals in the Civil War worshipped at the altar of Napoleon. And Napoleonic tactics were considered the best possible tactics, and they worked fantastically in the early 1800s, back when you had muskets, but they don't work in the 1860s when you have rifles and men are just being mowed down. Something similar happens with Germany in the beginning of World War I. All of their strategy is based on winning a battle very quickly, or at least knocking France out of the war in a matter of weeks. Now, they had precedent for believing that, because Germany succeeded in defeating the French in 6 weeks in the Franco-Prussian War of 1871. Plans for decades had been predicated on the same thing. But by the 1910s, things are very different. Germany doesn't enjoy the same arms advantage over France as they do in the 1870s. They don't have the same element of surprise. France didn't expect a small little German principality to rise up and defeat them, but France is preparing in kind for something like that to happen. And the plan doesn't work when you're thinking about fighting a global war on multiple fronts, leading to a case where you have a defensive war where Germany's resources are bled out when the British Navy could block the English Channel and basically landlocked Germany. So there's a lot of factors going on. Suffice it to say that basing a future war on the plans of the previous war almost never works. It's very hard not to do that, but that leads to some of the mistakes and problems we're going to see early on here. So, James, what's going on with German and French plans?
All right. The Germans had been planning on a war with France and or Russia for a long time. They didn't want to just figure it out when it happened, like, oh, let's just make it up as we go. So they had spent years honing and then perfecting a plan, which was named after its original author, and it was called the Schlieffen Plan. The Schlieffen Plan was developed originally long before the war by General Alfred von Schlieffen, who was the chief of the General Staff of Germany from 1891 to 1906. So we're talking long before the war actually broke out. Germany was planning for how are we going to deal with France? How are we going to deal with Russia? As we said in the last episode, Germany feared Russia and they wanted to neutralize the threat from Russia, but they didn't want to risk a two-front war. And the Schlieffen Plan was designed to eliminate the threat of a two-front war. So the first part of the plan would involve a giant German army marching quickly through Holland and Belgium, violating their neutrality, and into France. And he chose to march through Belgium because the southern, you may say, why not just go straight from Germany into France through Alsace-Lorraine? The problem with that is that was the most heavily fortified area of France. The French were expecting that to happen. That was a natural area of invasion. So they fortified it. They beefed it up. Anyway, so the Germans would instead go through Belgium, possibly Holland. And once the army entered France, it would swing around, envelop Paris, and capture the city along with all French forces in the north. So this would be the right wing of the German line. The German line would stretch all the way from almost the coast of the English Channel in the North Sea all the way down to Switzerland. But the most important part was the German right, which again is the north. Actually, in our previous battle, the German right was the south because they're moving toward the east. But now, obviously, they're moving toward the west. Schlieffen had written, "When you march into France, let the last man on the right brush the channel with his sleeve." So, in other words, stay close. He was obsessed with the plan his whole life. Supposedly, on his deathbed, he was quoted as saying, "Take care of the right," or something like that. So to his very death, he was still thinking about his precious plan of attack and making sure that the right wing stayed strong. And the plan was for the whole operation to take about 6 weeks. That's the plan. That's the paper plan. We'll see how that works out later. So we're going to knock out France in 6 weeks. And once France was defeated, then Germany could turn and face Russia, which Schlieffen assumed would take much longer to mobilize than either Germany or France. And by the time Russia had mobilized, France would be defeated. And again, in his excellent podcast series on World War I, Dan Carlin compares this to a bar fight. So imagine if you go to a bar and you know you're going to have to fight two people. You don't want to have to fight both at the same time. So you get there early and you fight the guy who's there first and you knock him out. And then you realize 5 minutes later, the other guy is going to come. So you knock the first one out really quickly and then you can focus entirely on the second one. Well, the first guy in this analogy is France and the second guy is Russia. So we're going to knock out France and then we can deal with Russia. After Schlieffen's death, his successor, Helmut von Moltke, who we've mentioned already quite a few times, he's the chief of the German general staff, the top general in the German army. He modified the plan somewhat. He dropped the march through Holland, allocated more forces to the southern border with France. So he gave a little more emphasis on the German left, which is the south, and a little less emphasis on the right, which is the north. But nevertheless, that's still going to be the tip of the spear, the German right, the northern part that's going to sweep through Belgium and sweep across France and circle Paris and surround it and take it over, bag it. Similar to what happened in the Franco-Prussian War, but on a much larger scale. Let's see. The plan was extremely risky, and it was perhaps unrealistic. And because Schlieffen died in 1913, before the war even broke out, it has sometimes been said that a dead man had his finger on the trigger. So it's like we're sticking to this plan, and this man is not even alive anymore, and yet he's dictating what we're going to do. Some question that. Now, let me give you a mental map of the armies. And to do this, I'm going to borrow from the American scholar G.J. Meyer, who has my favorite one-volume work on World War I. If you only read one book on World War I, to me, this would be the one. This is what he says. He says, picture a clock with Paris at its center. All right, everybody got that? Clock, Paris in the middle, good. The line of armies was in the upper right portion of the clock's face, extending roughly from 1 to 3 o'clock. The biggest and northernmost of these armies, positioned to the north and east of Liège, which is part of Belgium, and we'll talk about how they got there in a minute, was commanded by General Alexander von Kluck. He was, and we'll talk more about von Kluck later, but so basically think about the clock and think about the German army stretching from 1 down to 3. That's just the right wing, and if you go around the clock, you're going down to, say, maybe 4 o'clock. That's the whole army. And then the French are opposing them. And we're going to see the British are going to join the party a little bit later. Germany had 750,000 men in its right wing alone, just the right wing. And I'll tell you this, too. They numbered the armies and they deployed them in numerical order. And that was very kind of them. It was very thoughtful. They were thinking of all future historians so we don't, so we can remember this. The first army is the furthest to the north, commanded by Kluck. And then you had the second below it and the third and so on, all the way down to, I think it goes up to the seventh. I'm drawing a blank here, but it doesn't matter. We're going to focus mainly on the First and Second Armies in this narrative. The French army was laid out the opposite way. So their first army was furthest to the south, near Alsace-Lorraine, near the Swiss border. And then they went 1, 2, 3, 4 from south to north up to the fifth. Now, speaking of France, France had their own plan. France's plan was not just to sit there and take it on the chin. They were going to fight back. They had a plan called Plan 17, and it's called that because they had 16 before that. The Plan 17 called for an all-out attack into Germany to regain Alsace and Lorraine. They wanted their territory back. These two provinces had been taken by Germany in the Franco-Prussian War. The people there were mainly French speakers. They were French in culture and in the way they saw themselves, and France wanted them back. So their plan was to hit in the most southern part of the lines, whereas the Germans were going to focus on their right, which is the most northern part. And France, more than any other nation, I think, at this time, at the beginning of the war at least, their military doctrine has often been called the cult of the offensive. The cult of the offensive.
They just love to go for it. I mean, whether it's with bayonets against machine guns, they'll go after it.
Yeah, I mean, these are the descendants of the French army that fought under Napoleon, and they wanted to just charge, you know, elan vital. They wanted to just go and attack and attack and attack. And at the time, the concept of fighting from behind any kind of fortifications, let alone trenches. Trenches are not even in the mindset right now. But I mean, not only that, but they wore uniforms that were brightly colored. They had a bright blue coat, kind of like the Union Army and kind of like previous French armies. They wore bright red pants, which were basically like a target. You might as well have a neon sign saying, hit me. They didn't wear helmets. They didn't have steel helmets. To be fair, a lot of the troops didn't at the beginning, but they wore soft caps. The officers would charge around on horseback with white gloves on and holding a saber in the air and charge, you know, just like it's some kind of Napoleonic cavalry charge. So they were very much mired in the past in many ways, not completely, but they were offensive. They didn't believe in defense, but that is going to, they're going to learn very quickly that that doesn't work in 1914, right?
Yeah. I mean, this is at the end of the Belle Époque, very romantic period in France. And there's a book called Rendezvous with Death about Americans who volunteer to fight in the Foreign Legion before America formally joins the war. And it describes the mood in Paris that there is a dark cloud descending, but at the same time, many who are in cafes and other places are filled with romantic notions and elan about fighting in the war. And there's also the symbolic aspect of retaking Alsace-Lorraine, that this is something that was rightfully ours, and we can fulfill the dreams of our fathers and grandfathers. So there's millions of young Frenchmen, they're mustering on the village greens and in town and city squares and the cobblestone streets, ready to board railway cars to go up to the front and with their sharpened bayonets to go against machine guns and other things too. So, but all that to say, France didn't roll over the way that Germany thought it would. It had been dreaming of this many for decades to be able to avenge what they thought was an unjust loss. So this is also going to throw another wrench into the plans. What happens next, James?
Okay, so the Plan 17 underestimated German reserves in the area. Germany had a very elaborate system of reserves and backup troops, and almost in some ways, almost like the National Guard. They could call up people who were older, who had been in the military in the past, call it back to active duty. As I mentioned, the French soldiers marched into battle against the Germans with bright blue and red uniforms, officers mounted on horseback, waving sabers. When the plan was launched, the Germans actually started retreating. They backed up, and by doing this, they drew the southernmost part of the French line further away from French forces in the north, which were being attacked as a part of the Schlieffen Plan, as we'll see in a little bit. The Germans retreated into Alsace and Lorraine, about 4 miles or so. Then they stood their ground and they gave the French heavy resistance. German gunners on hilltops mowed down the French, who were advancing along open fields much of the time. They were just out in the open, just standing up, marching along, just like it's a parade or something, and they paid a dear price for it. On August 22nd alone, get this, France suffered 27,000 soldiers killed, 27 dead. That's not casualties. That is dead on one day, August 22nd, due to German machine gun and artillery fire, primarily. Some rifle fire as well. But this is the greatest number of war deaths suffered by a single nation on a single day in the entire war. So here we are just weeks into the war, and France really, really takes a major hit. Let me put that in perspective, Scott. 27,000 killed on one day. Again, let's compare to the American Civil War. The bloodiest battle of the American Civil War in terms of total casualties was Gettysburg. Gettysburg lasted 3 days, and both sides combined had about 7,000 killed. So both sides had 7,000 killed over the course of 3 days. Here we have 27,000 killed on one day. That's simply amazing. The bloodiest one-day battle in the Civil War is Antietam, and it wasn't even 7,000 killed. It was much fewer. So by the end of August, France had lost 75,000 killed, plus 200,000 others wounded, missing, and captured, and they had to retreat back into France. So Plan 17, the French hoped for, planned for advance into Alsace-Lorraine to liberate those territories from Germany, is completely thrown back, and it's an utter failure.
Yeah, I mean, I hope listeners are starting to understand when we mentioned that this is a seismic event in Europe. Now you see why, where an entire generation is being lost of the Civil War, which caused more casualties than any war in American history, pales in comparison to World War One. And France, this is a closing of a chapter for them, where in the beginning, they think they'll sweep the German army, using a term, attack à outrance, I'm sure I mispronounced that, an attack to the excess, where they're relying on elan, they're going to charge with bayonets that could trump high explosives and machine guns. France isn't innocent in this, though, because if they had observed earlier wars like the Balkan Wars or the Boer War, that mechanization and industrialization is changing the calculus of everything. And that's going to become abundantly clear if it isn't already clear based on the loss they suffered. But something else to dispel any notion of this being a romantic, dashing war where you could write volumes of poetry about, like the Crimean War or other things like that, is going to end in Belgium in August. So what's happening there, James?
So as we mentioned, part of the Schlieffen Plan, and modified by Moltke, was for the Germans to march right through Belgium, violating their neutrality, despite them having signed an agreement back in the 1830s to respect Belgian neutrality. Now, before they did this, before they marched into Belgium, Germany had warned Belgium not to resist their advance. They told the Belgians, basically, just stand aside. We'll march through. We won't cause any damage. If we do, we'll pay for it. We'll try not to break anything, in other words. But you just don't try to stop us. Don't blow up any bridges or roads or railroad tracks or tunnels or anything like that. Just don't interfere. Don't do anything. Let us go through. As if the Belgians are just going to stand there and clap for them and cheer and, you know, give them high fives and maybe hand them water bottles like it's a marathon or something. But needless to say, the Belgians said no. Their king, King Albert, said absolutely not. They did just the opposite. The Belgians actually did, when the Germans started to come in. They destroyed bridges and railroads. They obstructed roads. And they deployed snipers in towns and other locations who picked off many German soldiers. This brought back memories of the Franc-tireurs. I don't know if I said that correctly. Those were French snipers during the Franco-Prussian War. But Scott's going to talk more about that later. But needless to say, the Germans were, their path through Belgium was not anywhere near as clear as they thought it was going to be. The Belgians refused to play ball with them. And in fact, it really slowed down the German advance.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
The Germans crossed the Belgian border on August 4th, moving at 30 kilometers per day. You know, roughly...
That's quite a clip. Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty good. And as they went through, the Germans... It's not as fast as they wanted to, though, thanks to the, you know, doggone Belgians. What is wrong with these Belgians? They're supposed to just let us walk through. But anyway, sorry, that's my bad German accent, but y'all are going to have to just deal with that, too. As they went through, the Germans committed many atrocities against Belgian civilians and Belgian property. They killed, all in all, about 6,000 civilians. Now, their excuse was, you know, these are snipers and we're going to punish. Sometimes they would punish an entire village if one sniper took out one German soldier. They believed in group punishment. They believed in the policy of terror. We saw how the Austrians used this against the Serbs. Now the Germans are going to use it against the Belgians. This is what happens to people that mess with Germany. So if we just make an example of 100 people here, 200 people here, or whatever, then other people will stop and they'll be too scared to oppose us. That went well. It didn't go well. It went horribly. The Belgians, to their credit, continued to fight. One of the things the Germans did was they burned an ancient library in Louvain, along with much of the city. And this, I should say that this was a great blow to scholars all over the place, professors. There were many ancient medieval manuscripts there that just went up in smoke. It was just an innumerable loss. They also drove 10,000 civilians from the city of Louvain. They created many, many refugees. And they shelled the Cathedral of Reims. And I'm sorry if I didn't say that one right. I forgot to ask my friend about that one. But beautiful ancient cathedral, gone. So the Germans are not playing nice. They're not just focusing on strictly military targets. They are cutting a swath of terror as they went through.
Right. And just a couple of other things that are going on here in Louvain, because this is an important moment. This becomes a rallying cry. This is what Britain seizes on. It becomes a propaganda effort. There are, yes, postcards made about the event, and it shocks Britain, and it affects how they are looking at this whole matter. So along with what James said, the city's burned, and hundreds of civilians were lined up and shot in revenge for... James mentioned franc-tireurs. I probably also mispronounce it. So if you know French, take a drink. I guess that will be part of the drinking game there.
Vive la France!
So what they were, this is a name given to Belgian guerrilla fighters that used the civilian population as a shield to strike at the invaders. And like James said, German high command decided the way to deal with this was collective responsibility for German deaths. It's, who knows, maybe somebody read a book on General Sherman in the Civil War and figured that if we do that, that'll work better. Although they took it further than Sherman, which was a main point of his. What they would do is murder innocent civilians and cow the population. The library, which dates back to 1426, that just saddens my heart to think of all the things that would have been lost there are gone. And one quote or one description from that event says, "The town's residents were kept in the main square until evening, then lined up, women on one side, men opposite in two rows, one kneeling in front of the other. Two firing squads marched to the center of the square, faced either way, and fired until no more of the targets stood upright. 612 bodies were identified and buried, including Felix Fivette, aged 3 weeks." So this gets major international press, and this really turns the tide of opinion against Germany.
Yes, definitely. And there, obviously, these are horrible atrocities, horrible things, and they certainly don't do much to boost German PR around the world. They don't. The Germans are always saying, well, we're just fighting to preserve ourselves. We're really the defensive. We're striking out because if we don't, we'll get attacked. They're trying to make themselves out to be the good guys, but this kind of makes that really hard to believe. Having said that, the Allies, especially the British, who were masters of PR, they played up German atrocities. They exaggerated them. They even invented things. They invented stories like the Germans cutting off body parts and taking priests and making them human clappers and the church bells and things like that. Just really blew them up to really make the Germans look like the bad guys. The Germans are these barbarians. They started calling them Huns. Exactly. This is going to have major effects in the future because it's going to lead to future skepticism about atrocities. And this is even going to affect World War II. This is part of why the world was slow to react to the early stories about the Holocaust, because they said, oh, they're just blowing it out of proportion. A lot of people in America said in World War I, the British made up these stories and the French made up stories. And so we just can't believe what they say. You know, fake news, right? So so that's why a lot of people were skeptical of the Holocaust at first. Anyway, so back to Belgium. What's going on with the Belgian army at this time? They were a lot of them were holed up in a series of forts near Liège. Liège was a major fortification center. These had been built much earlier. There was a ring of forts, about a dozen of them, plus a central stockade or fort or whatever you want to call it. There's a word for fort, citadel. Yeah, the citadel. That's the word I was looking for, is in the center. And these forts were massive. They were mostly underground. They were made of solid steel and reinforced concrete. But despite this, German artillery, which was super advanced technologically, reduced them to rubble. The Germans are using guns that the world had never seen before. Some of these guns had a range of 9 miles, and they fired a 3-foot-long shell that weighed about 1,800 pounds, or up to 2,200 pounds, I've read in some sources. So we're talking, they're firing something that is the weight of a car, a small car, you know? And they had a delayed detonation, so they would fire them almost straight up in the air, and then they would go up, and they would come down and pick up momentum, and then the shells would crash through these concrete forts. And then when they'd crash through to the bottom, they would then explode, and they would just completely reduce each fort to rubble and kill everybody inside of them, or almost everybody. They had to be fired electrically from 300 yards away, and their crews had to protect their eyes. They had to lie on the ground, put cotton in their ears, eyes, and mouths, open their mouths so that the shock and the great roar did not just blow out their eardrums. So, I mean, this is just something the world has never seen before. The Belgians had no idea what was coming. These guns were so big, they had to be sent by rail, disassembled. They had to be sent in parts and then assembled at the site, and they had to be put into concrete so that it wouldn't just, you know, like go way far away, to roll away or fly away or whatever. I don't know what they would do, but they had to be anchored down, is my point. Now, as the German army entered Liège with these forts being destroyed, there was a certain general, and we've already met him. Maybe we should have done this one first, Scott. I don't know, but technically Tannenberg is actually before the Battle of the Marne, so that's why I wanted to put it first. But pretend you guys have never heard of Eric Ludendorff, okay? I'm holding up.
Gotcha. Okay. It's forgotten.
I'm holding up one of those memory erasers like in the movie Men in Black. And there you go. All right.
You've been flashy things, people.
That's right.
For a second. We'll restore your memories in a second.
Yes. So there was a staff officer, Eric Ludendorff, and he was not a battlefield commander, but he was there visiting and observing. And he noticed that one of the generals leading one of the brigades of the German army had fallen. And so he assumed command. He rallied the troops, and he personally marched up to the main door of the citadel. He banged on the door with the hilt of his sword and demanded the city's surrender. And by golly, it did. So he was that forceful a person. And of course, we saw it in the third episode that he's going to go on to be General Hindenburg's right-hand man out in the east. All right. Now, we're done with the attack on Belgium. It's also sometimes called the Rape of Belgium, and we're going to move on to the next phase. Scott, do you want to add anything?
It's just interesting to mention that, I mean, with this gun that you discussed that could fire a shell that weighed 1,800 pounds, I think for ballistics, they had to figure in the curvature of the earth with some of these because they fired so long. And there are some facts that say that the amount of tonnage that's being fired per second in World War I, it's absolutely mind-boggling. And later on in the series, we'll get into the introduction of never-before-seen weapons, like tank warfare. And if you look at tanks in 1914, they look like rickety contraptions, like it's something out of a steampunk novel, and wonder how they are even able to lumber across the field. But when you read accounts of people there on the time, it's as shocking to them as if, I don't know, a satyr or a dragon or a medieval monster appeared out of nowhere that your mind can't even comprehend what you're seeing or experiencing. So there's a level of horror and terror that grips people in a way because they can't comprehend it. Men on horseback, cavalry charges they can understand, musket and rifle volleys and cannon volleys they can understand, but this they don't have a place in their mind for. So it's just going to keep going up and up.
Yeah. I mean, artillery has been around obviously for a long time. Napoleon used it. It was very important in the American Civil War, but not this kind of artillery. Those were largely smoothbore cannons. They had some rifled cannon in the Civil War, but the distance, the power, the force, the size of the projectiles was absolutely nothing compared to this. All right, so let's move on now to the next phase. And this is the prelude to the Battle of the Marne. We're still not to the Marne, people. Sorry, but we want to set the stage and let you know how it came to pass. And we're going to look at the initial attack into France by the German army. And that is often, it's called collectively the Battle of the Frontiers. But again, don't think of the Battle of the Frontiers as a single unified battle like the Battle of Gettysburg or the Battle of Shiloh or something like that. It's a series of engagements up and down a very long front, and it lasts for almost a month. And yeah, again, how do you decide on what the first day is and what the last day is? If you look in different books, you will see different things. So I'm going to say August 7th to September 4th, but you could certainly argue that it started earlier or later and that it ended earlier or later. Now, hopefully I've completely confused everybody. Let's try to unconfuse you a little bit. All right. So a total of 6 million men were rushed into the initial conflict. And the French knew they were going to need help. And they had agreed, the British had agreed to come over and help. We've talked already about the BEF, the British Expeditionary Force. They mobilized quickly and they reached the city of Mons. And the S is pronounced, according to my French friend, Mons. And that's where it's north of where the French line is, and they turned away a German attack on August 23rd. It's called sometimes the Battle of Mons. The British riflemen were really, really good. The British army really stressed marksmanship to a degree that no other army really did. And plus the British army had a lot of battle-hardened combat veterans. They had fought in the Boer War, maybe, what was that, like 15 years before, a little 10 to 15. It went on for a while. So,
yeah, Churchill was did he fight in that, or was he a war correspondent?
Yeah, I think he was a correspondent. I think he got captured at one point. I don't know, but and Churchill will figure into this war as well, where he's going to pop in and out from time to time.
Oh yes,
these British riflemen were so good; they could shoot so quickly. They would fire several rounds a minute. The Germans thought they were facing machine gun fire, but it wasn't. But eventually they were overwhelmed. The force was very small. They were good, but they were small. The British commander was named, and here's another confusing situation, folks. I apologize. But the overall commander was Sir John French. His last name is French, which is ironic because he hated the French. And he did not...
Not the German commander, Francois.
Yeah, and it's like, well, all we need is like a French commander named, von Rinkendorf or something like that. I don't know. So as the British were being pushed back, their commander, Sir John, I just call him Sir John sometimes, Sir John French, he actually considered evacuating them, like bugging out. Nah, sorry, France. This is more than we bargained for. We're gone. He wanted to retreat. He thought about moving them way back. He even thought about going back to Britain. But fortunately for the French and perhaps for everyone, not for the Germans, obviously, but his boss, Lord Kitchener, who was the war minister in the British cabinet, he ordered him to stay. So so the British army is going to stay and they're going to fight. Now, the BEF and the French army both quickly retreated. They retreated and retreated and retreated. The Germans drove them back. They were trying to find a better location to make a stand. They ended up retreating 200 miles into France, And they ended up deploying on the Marne River, which is not very far from Paris. The Germans are getting close to their goal of Paris. And this is known as the Great Retreat. And it lasted for quite some time, almost 2 weeks, August 24th through September 5th. As the German army crossed into France, the French government fled. They relocated to Bordeaux, nice and far away. But the army planned to defend Paris. They mined the bridges of Paris in case the Germans reached it. But the German offensive, even though it had been just chugging along and overcoming many obstacles and making a lot of progress, it was finally slowed by a variety of factors. There was stubborn rearguard actions on the part of the British and the French. You had British and French cavalry blinding German cavalry reconnaissance. Excuse me. And yes, you did have cavalry. Cavalry plays a pretty important part, especially in the beginning of the war. And another thing that was relatively new, air reconnaissance, which is going to replace cavalry as your main source of intel, if you will, or information about your opponent. The Germans didn't have very good air reconnaissance. And the problem of supply, which always dogs every army. The further the Germans advanced from their railheads, the harder it became to supply their army. The German army is getting tired. They'd been marching nonstop for days and days and days. Some of the units hadn't eaten in a long time. Their uniforms were wearing out. Their shoes were wearing out. So they were starting to be kind of a mess. Right, Scott?
Yeah, it's a double-edged sword where on the one hand, Germany has the most sophisticated logistics network, the most elaborate system of rail lines, so they can move equipment around very quickly. But when you're more dependent on it and you're expecting a railroad line to be able to deliver a gigantic piece of artillery, if you don't have that, that can affect your war plans. We'll talk more about fighter pilots and air reconnaissance later, but I will say that from everything I've read of being a pilot in World War One, it seems so terrifying. I'm not sure which is worse, being a fighter pilot in World War One or being on the CMS Hundley, the Civil War submarine for the Confederacy. Which is a bigger death trap? There's an argument to be made on both sides. So,
oh, well, the Hundley had 100% death rate. All three of their crews bit the dust, drowned or suffocated.
I guess the Hundley wins then.
You know, so. Hard to top that. You know, you're guaranteed. They didn't know it at the time. You know, Scott, I'm terrible about remembering numbers in the context of history. I'm good with numbers. I used to teach math, but I have trouble remembering casualty numbers and percentages, but I believe, if I'm remembering correctly, about 50% of all World War One pilots died. So that's pretty bad. You know, you have a 1 in 2 chance of not coming back eventually.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors. A lot of them were really cocky and they had special treatment, but others didn't begrudge them because they thought, well, he's a dead man walking anyway. So Whatever, let him out his fun.
Okay. So we end up this battle of the frontiers, this German push through northern France toward Paris. We end up with several casualties. Obviously Britain suffered about 30,000 casualties. France, 330,000. Of course, remember that the British army is far smaller than either the French or the German at this point. Germany had about 260,000 casualties. I don't have figures on how many were actually dead or killed, but that's nevertheless, you can figure it's maybe, I don't know, a fourth, a fifth of those, maybe a little less. So a lot were killed in this 1 month. And this prompts some changes to the armies and to the plan. In August, the German Supreme Commander Moltke, who we've already mentioned many, many times, Moltke sent 2 Army Corps to be sent to the Eastern Front to aid against the Russians. We saw that in the last episode on the Battle of Tannenberg, that it turned out they weren't needed. Although, of course, they could have not known that. It seemed at the time that they were needed because the Germans were outnumbered 2-1 by the Russians. But the Germans are going to pull some tactical wizardry, a.k.a. a la Robert E. Lee. So those divisions, those corps were not needed. They really were needed in the West. So that creates a problem. The Schlieffen Plan depended, as we've seen, on a huge presence on the German right or the north. the part that was going to sweep around Paris, but now it's been stripped of some of its force. Now, near the end of the month, the French cobbled together a new army. We saw they had only had five armies compared to seven on the German side. The BEF helped add part of an army to that, but the French recruited more people, they shaked the bushes, and they created a sixth army opposite the German right. And this creation of this new army motivated General Kluck, the commander of the German First Army. Remember, he's on the far edge. He's the far right. He's the guy that's supposed to have people that are getting their sleeves wet on the English Channel. He decides that I want to go attack that army instead. So he changes the direction of his march. Instead of continuing to sweep west with a view towards sweeping around Paris from behind, he turns to the southeast, heading head on for this army, trying to attack them and hopefully wipe them out. So he decides to go for an army rather than a city, which in general is a good idea, but I don't know if it's going to work out too well here. We'll see. And Moltke agreed to this change, and he was hoping to entrap the French forces between Paris and Verdun. Verdun, we'll talk a lot about that later. It's an old historic French fortress to the south. And so this, you could in some way say, this is the end of the Schlieffen Plan. This is where the Schlieffen Plan halts, and they toss it out the window and they change to another plan. And again, like I said, plans don't really last very long in war, usually. In the meantime, the supreme commander of the French army, Marshal Joseph Joffre, and it's J-O-F-F-R-E, and you pronounce the R-E just a little bit. Some people say Joffre without even doing the R-E, but it's hard for an English speaker, but Joffre. Anyway, he was a tiger, man. He was a very energetic commander. He was just what France needed at the time. He went around and fired a lot of his generals. He replaced army commanders, corps commanders, division commanders, brigade commanders. He fired up to 140 of his generals.
Wow, fruit basket upset.
Yeah, you know, he said, hey, you're not tough enough. You just didn't cut it. A lot of these French generals were mainly paper pushers. You know, they were like General Halleck in the Civil War. Great academicians and great planners, but lousy battlefield commanders. And he brought up some younger, more energetic, and more talented battle commanders. And people like General Foch, which we'll talk about later. General Pétain, they're going to start coming up through the ranks. Nivelle, they're going to have a big future. They're starting to rise up through the ranks. Joffre also reorganized his army, showing complete calmness all along. I love this guy, Scott. This guy, one thing, he was a big man. He was very tall. He was a colorful character. He was very large. He was, you know, larger than life, and he was also large physically. But two things I like about him. He always got a good night's sleep, and he never missed a meal. He never let people interrupt his meals. You know, he knew what was important in life, a good meal and a good night's sleep. You know, you don't see that a lot in generals. Generals are famous during wars for not eating or sleeping properly. But anyway, so that's what we've got so far. The Germans have pushed the French and the British back, pushed them back, and finally the French and the British have their backs up almost against Paris, and they realize they're going to have to take a stand.
All right. Well, that's a lot to set up. And to France's credit, they almost seem to be doing what Abraham Lincoln did after 4 years, except they do it very quickly in the war after a few months of Lincoln finally cycling through generals and then finding who they need and perhaps averting catastrophic defeat. We can say this maybe once we get to the end of the Battle of the Marne later on, but I'll be curious if you think, had Germany kept to the Schlieffen plan and continued to keep to the right, as he may have said on his deathbed, could it have turned out better for Germany instead of going after an army, or even worse? I love these what ifs, but we can stick and fork in that for a second.
That is a question that has been debated for over 100 years, and books have been written about it. And I honestly don't know. The German army on the far right, Kluck's army, the First Army, and the Second Army under General von Bülow, they were, as I mentioned, they were exhausted, they were tired, they were hungry, they were running out of supplies. I don't know that they could have marched much further than they did. I really don't, Scott. I don't think they could have stuck to the original plan. And they had to be flexible. They had to react to the formation of this new French army. There's going to be another one too, the Ninth Army. You can't just say, well, this is my plan, and I'm going to stick to it no matter what. I don't care what actually happens on the battlefield. I'm just going to go with the plan. You can't do that. You have to make adjustments based on what is actually going on the ground. So I don't think they could have gone through with the Schlieffen plan. If they had tried, I think they would have suffered greatly. Now, I might be wrong. Listeners, you can comment if you want and tell us what you think, but that's my thought on it.
Sorry, Schlieffen. I guess he'll just be upset from beyond the grave.
Yeah, but I mean, the Schlieffen plan was really kind of a roll of the dice to start with. You know, it depended on great swiftness, quickness. You had to get through Belgium really quick, take Paris in 6 weeks. That was probably unrealistic. It assumed that Belgium would not be much of a problem, which Belgium turned into a pretty big problem. All right, so let's see what happens. And we're finally getting to the Battle of the Marne. And again, the Battle of the Marne, when did it start? When did it finish? It's hard to say. I wrote down September 5 through September 10. And it's basically what happened when the French and the British finally stopped retreating, turned around to face the Germans, and we'll see what happens. By September 5th, the German army had been marching and or fighting for 33 straight days. As I mentioned, they were exhausted. Supplies were beginning to run out. And another thing of interest happened. A gap opens up between the First Army and the Second Army, the two armies on the far German right, closest to the sea, furthest to the north. And Marshal Joffre met with Sir John French, the British Supreme Commander, trying to convince him to join the French in a counterattack. The meeting ended, you know, and Sir John was not real sure if he wanted to do this. I don't know. And finally, according to most sources, the meeting ended with Joffre banging his hand dramatically on a table and shouting, "Monsieur le Maréchal, the honor of England is at stake." Okay, bad French accent. But basically saying the honor of England is at stake. And French, Sir John French said, okay, well, if you put it that way, fine, yeah.
He played him like a fiddle and it worked.
Exactly, nice. Yeah. When you start talking about honor to the British, you got them. So at the Marne River, the BEF, the British Army that was there at the time, they advanced into the gap created by the Germans, and they were threatening to cut off the First Army and possibly even get in the rear of the First or the Second Army. At one point, the gap was 35 miles wide. The French Army also attacked. It was aided by a fleet, and this is a great story. I love the story of the Marne. In Paris, in the city of Paris, there were several thousand soldiers there to guard the city. And the commander there, a man named General Galliani, he put the soldiers in Paris into taxi cabs. And the taxi cabs shuttled them from Paris to the battlefield on September 6th. Now, I've seen all kinds of numbers on how many taxi cabs were involved. I've seen as low as 400. I've seen as high as 1,200. So I'll split the difference and go 600 or 700. I don't know. But can you imagine, like, the French army doesn't even have its own transport, enough transport to get its own troops to the front. They have to commandeer these taxis. That's just a great story.
I just imagine, I mean, I'm sure they weren't let out anywhere near the front, but in my mind's eye, I see right near the front with barbed wire and trenches, which don't exist yet, but bear with me, that a taxi opens up, two French soldiers get out, they tip their driver, and then they start firing at the Germans from across the trench. Yeah.
Well, the good thing for the taxi drivers is they did get paid. The government paid 70,000 francs total to the drivers.
Oh, all right.
So, as we saw, the British and the French made a stand at the Marne River, and the German forces realized they had to fall back. They fell back to the Aisne River. They crossed it, and they began to dig in. And here we go. The Schlieffen plan had failed, and we're going to see the beginning of the era of trench warfare. Now, we don't have the elaborate networks of trenches just yet, but they're getting started. And the commander on the German side, Moltke, suffered a nervous breakdown. He sent a message, supposedly, to the Kaiser saying, "Your Majesty, we have lost the war." So that's not good for Germany. It's like we rolled the dice, we put all our chips on the table, and we lost. But the war is far from lost at this point. The Kaiser replaced Moltke with the man who at the time was the war minister in the German government, Erich von Falkenhayn. And in the Battle of the Marne, the British suffered 13,000 casualties, 1,700 dead. The French, another 250,000 casualties, 80,000 dead.
Wow.
80,000. I mean, it's just like, you know, I keep thinking of Gettysburg, and it's like every day there's a Gettysburg. You know, it's just crazy. Germany, 250,000 casualties, 67,000 dead. The total casualties were 500,000, 500,000 casualties, almost 150,000 dead. But the German advance and the assault on Paris had been halted, at least for the time.
Well, yeah, this is getting to a point where it's hard for people to imagine, because the total casualty number of the American Expeditionary Force when they get involved in World War One later, correct me if I'm wrong, doesn't come anywhere close to this.
No, I don't have the number off the tip of my tongue, but it's somewhere around the vicinity of 100,000 killed. And, you know, we're seeing, all these sides have already lost this. We're a month into it, you know.
And even the total numbers for World War II for the United States aren't much higher than this either. So, and this is going to drag on and on. So it's great that you're pausing and emphasizing these points that entire campaigns in the Civil War or totals of the American Revolutionary War barely scratching just a few days or one battle in World War One.
Yeah, I haven't been keeping a tally on our deaths so far. Maybe one of our listeners could do that. But if you think of in the American Civil War, somewhere between 600,000 and 750,000 were killed, and that's both sides together. I mean, I think we've already had that many. I can't.
Oh yeah.
But I mean, in just a month or so of fighting, especially if you throw in the Eastern Front too. So, we need to wrap up with one more thing. We see the battle line is stretching at this time, by the end of the Battle of the Marne, all the way down from the Swiss border up north to northern France, but not yet to the coast. And each side thought if we could just go around the other side, if we could move further north toward the English Channel coast, we could get around the other side. There's that old Napoleonic turning maneuver again. It's older than Napoleon, to be honest with you, but the idea, if we could get around their flank, get around their side, get in their rear, we can cause a lot of trouble. So both sides, the next thing they did after the battle was they attempted to turn the northern flank of the other side. And so they kept extending their lines further and further and further north until both sides' flanks reached the English Channel in the North Sea. And this has become known as the race to the sea. It's not that they were really trying to say, hey, I'll race you. Who can reach the sea first? Ready? Go. I mean, obviously, that's kind of a misleading term. It's really the race to turn the enemy's flank. But they both run out of flank. They both get to the ocean. So now the lines stretch all the way from the coast down to Switzerland, several hundred miles. The British tried an attack at the Aisne River. It didn't work. Both sides began to dig in, and the age of trench warfare has begun. The Germans laid siege to Antwerp, the last holdout major city in Belgium. It surrendered. Then in October 18th, there was a battle fought at this Belgian city of Ypres. And I probably didn't say that right. It's Ypres. Some sources just say Ypres, but my French friend said you do pronounce the R-E-S just a little bit, so Ypres. And there's going to be several battles here, as we will see. It's funny, Scott, the English soldiers mispronounced it. They called it Wipers. Wipers, the Battle of Wipers.
Yipers, Y-P-R-E-S.
Yeah, Yipers. Yeah, it kind of makes sense. The Germans attacked at Ypres, and the British fought them off using quick rifle fire once again and superior machine guns. And in this one, you had another roughly 150,000 Allied casualties, 130 German. And it was looking like the Germans might prevail. And then the Belgians did something really crafty and really sneaky and smart. They opened the canal locks, Okay, this area has a lot of canals. It's very, very low. You know, this area is called the Low Countries, and there's a lot of swampy, marshy areas, and there's a lot of water that's being held by locks. And they opened them up, and it flooded the countryside. And before long, the Germans had this huge lake right in front of them. So the two sides were now separated by a lake, and that causes the German advance to halt. The French attacked the Germans in the Champagne region, but they made no gains. A few more minor battles occurred up and down the line. They didn't make our cut of 10 major battles, but there was fighting often, constantly. But for the most part, the two sides settled into their trenches for the foreseeable future. The Germans sent more soldiers to the Eastern Front. And so, during the first few months of the war, an average of 15,000 lives were lost each day. So I said, Scott, I said a Gettysburg every day. It's more like two Gettysburgs a day. That's just staggering. It's amazing.
Right. And it's just going to keep continuing onward. And the war is also going to shift because what we've seen so far in the first years, throw in your input too, James, just as general analysis, but this is similar to recent wars like the Balkan Wars, except on a much larger scale. You have war is mechanized in a way that it's never been before. But what's going to happen, and we're going to look in this a lot more detail the next episode on trench warfare specifically, is we see that the ability to kill, the technology available, machine guns, flamethrowers, tanks, aerial reconnaissance, gas, mustard gas, all these different things have advanced, but the tactics haven't caught up with it. They're not using combined arms assaults. They're still using assaults one after another after another. This is what causes trench warfare, and it's not until tactics evolve a few years into the future that they can break this logjam. So we're going to see what takes form here is what we understand World War One combat to look like normally. So any thoughts, James, before we close out?
No, I don't want to lengthen the episode much longer. This is already turning into a marathon. But yeah, what you said is certainly true. I agree with that. And the tactics are going to constantly evolve. You know, some people think of World War One as just a war where it was just trenches and nobody ever moved and nothing ever happened. But actually, there's a lot of micro changes, and we will see some major technological advances that are going to transform warfare and bring us into the era of World War II style war. So what we're going to do next time is we're going to take a break from the battle narrative, as we do sometimes in our series, and we're going to stop. Spend a couple of episodes discussing what it was like to be a soldier in World War One. So we'll spend episode 5 on just the common soldier. What was his equipment like? What did he eat? What kind of guns did they use? What was a daily routine? What was it like if somebody got wounded? What was medical care like? Things like that. And then in the next episode, we'll focus specifically on life in the trenches. What was trench warfare like? What was it like to actually be one of the guys down in the trench? So I think you guys will enjoy that. We're going to bring it down to the micro level, to the individual soldier level. We won't be talking about hundreds of thousands of people. We'll be talking about, like, what was it like for one French guy, one German guy, and so on. So I'm looking forward to that, Scott.
Me too. So until then, everyone, please keep your Authory Springfield clean. Be a good doughboy or dough girl. Eat your rations and keep your feet dry and avoid trench foot. See you then. Okay, well, that wraps things up for today's episode. Thank you so much for sticking with me to the end. Once again, I want to start things off by thanking the Spymasters of History Unplugged. I'll explain what that is in a second. Our fantastic Spymasters include Chris C., David Santee, Josh from VFW Post 2285, Jake Harrington, Jennifer French Lee, Josh Reddick, Jeff Mitchell, owner of Mountain West Commercial in Las Vegas, Michael from New York, Michael Piccinetti, Nick Brooks, Rob from Chicago, Ryan Gillen, Salvador Sanchez, Tom from Ohio, Moondoggy from Ohio, Bill Ivey, and Bruce Ashby from Wire Meets Wood Guitars at WMWGuitars.com. If you'd like to support the show, there's some very easy ways to do so. First, go to the site halfpricehistory.com. I've worked out an arrangement with a lot of the authors who've appeared on this show, and you can go there and get their books for 50% off. All you have to do is go to halfpricehistory.com and enter the promo code UNPLUGGED at checkout. Second, please leave a review and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast player of choice, whether Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher or whatever. Third, join our Facebook group. You can go to Facebook and search for History Unplugged. There, you can talk with other fans of the show about recent episodes, what you liked, what you didn't like. Also, I have exclusive content there, such as live streams, where I do live versions of podcast episodes, where you can leave feedback as I'm talking, and I will address it on air. Last, and I think this is the best, is to join our membership program, the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program for History Unplugged. If you go to patreon.com/unplugged, you can join the membership program at three levels. If you join at the Scout level, you'll get all 400 episodes of History Unplugged absolutely ad-free and early access to new episodes. If you join at the second level, the Intelligence Officer level, get all the stuff that Scouts get, along with bonus episodes. There's currently about 40 of them, including series on Audie Murphy and Operation Long Jump about the Nazi attempt to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you'll get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get a three-pack of hardcover history books, and you can find out what those are if you go to patreon.com/unplugged. Finally, you can ask me a question about history on absolutely any topic on earth, and I will research it and devote an entire episode to your question. Probably about 30% of the questions in the archive for the show have been based on these sorts of questions. So there you go. Go to patreon.com/unplugged to learn more. All right, well, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.